From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, exposing Putin's targeted assassination program, we talk with BuzzFeed Global Investigations editor Heidi Blake, author of the new book, From Russia with Blood. Blake's part of a team that uncovered evidence connecting Russian hitmen to 14 deaths on British soil, killings that attracted little interest from British authorities anxious to maintain ties with the Russian government.
You know, in one case, an individual directly in the crosshairs of the Kremlin who had apparently stabbed himself to death repeatedly with two knives, and there'd been no investigation. It had immediately been treated as a suicide.
Knowing that journalists in Russia have been murdered, Blake and her reporting team had to watch their backs.
This was a dicey ride investigating this story, and we had a number of fairly disturbing instances along the way.
Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews reissues of music performed by the late jazz pianist Errol Garner. Our guest, Heidi Blake, says it's well known that for years, critics of Vladimir Putin have been gunned down, poisoned, thrown from windows, hit by cars, and beaten to death in Russia. Less well known, she says, is Putin's aggressive campaign to kill his enemies on foreign soil, especially in Great Britain. Blake is global investigations editor for BuzzFeed News and part of a team that has connected Russian assassins to 14 suspicious deaths in the United Kingdom and one in the United States. She says many of the murders were treated as suicides or deaths from natural causes by government officials reluctant to jeopardize the country's diplomatic ties with Russia. The BuzzFeed team's investigation of Russian assassinations was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize last year. Heidi Blake has won many national and international media awards and is a former assistant editor of the UK's Sunday Times. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies about her new book, From Russia with Blood, the Kremlin's ruthless assassination program and Vladimir Putin's secret war on the West.
Heidi Blake, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, before we get to these many assassinations of Putin's opponents, I want to review a couple of events that have been reported before, but people may have forgotten, and they tell us something about the nature of the Putin regime. One was the series of bombings at apartment houses in Moscow in 1999, terribly lethal, as Putin was running for president for the first time. These were attributed by the government to the rebels fighting for the independence of Chechnya. What does the evidence say about the root of these attacks?
Well, as you say, these were a series of deadly bombings that took place in Moscow in 1999, and they were blamed very vociferously by Putin on the Chechen rebels and used as a pretext for bombing raids on Chechnya, which really allowed Putin to build himself up as a sort of strongman candidate for the presidency, you know, as the sort of strong and defiant leader who could really defend the Russian motherland against this threat. In fact, it became clear to critical observers fairly quickly that there were a number of suspicious elements about these bombings, chiefly that residents of an apartment block in Moscow, after several of the bombs had already gone off, killing hundreds of civilians, caught a couple of men planting a sack labeled sugar in the basement of the apartment block. Now, this triggered a manhunt by the local police looking for these two men who'd been seen planting this sack, which actually turned out to contain the explosive hexogen, which was controlled by the government of Russia at the time. It was a controlled substance. Now, that manhunt was called off, but not before it had become clear that the two men caught planting that sack had in fact been FSB officers, the FSB being Russia's security service. And that was the first in a long line of evidence that really pointed to involvement by the Russian state security apparatus in this series of bombings that were so deadly in Moscow. Now, the FSB had been headed by Vladimir Putin before his ascent to power. And so the fact that the FSB had its fingerprints on these bombings indicated that Putin had potentially been involved. And certainly the impact of those bombings was to allow Putin to build this platform from which he could fulminate against the threat of these Chechen rebels. And as I say, build himself up as this kind of strongman. And it really set the stage for his presidency, which has really been built around this idea of restoring Russian greatness and Russian might.
Now, you write in the book that covert killing was a particularly Soviet form of statecraft. This goes back decades. What do you mean?
That's right. So targeted assassination was a kind of tool of statecraft that really rested for many years in the hands of the KGB, the Soviet State Security Agency. And the KGB was famous for refining the kind of art and science of targeted killing and of, you know, of having weapons labs and poisons factories that churned out kind of weapons of assassination like ricin-tipped umbrellas, famously, for example, or lipstick pistols, or exploding cigarette packets. You know, the KGB famously was behind the assassination of Leon Trotsky with an ice pick. You know, there were many notorious and brazen KGB-linked assassinations during the Soviet era. But that capability had really dwindled since the fall of the Soviet Union. And it was really when Putin came to power, Putin himself having come up through the ranks of the KGB and being really a student and a kind of major fanboy of the Soviet Union and of the KGB, who grew up reading stories of you know, KGB spycraft, that he really began to pour resource back into tooling up the Russian state security apparatus to, you know, to once again re-engage in the art of targeted assassination.
With some really creative means, various poisoning and radiation and that kind of thing.
That's right, yeah. And part of what the you know, our research established was that Putin has, in a very concerted way, you know, poured resource into a number of laboratories in which government scientists just dedicate their lives to the development of weapons and poisons which are designed to kill without leaving a trace. So we know that the Russian state has a whole armory of poisons which are designed to trigger, for example, fast-acting cancers or to trigger cardiac arrest, or even psychotropic drugs which are designed to destabilize enemy targets, to, you know, mood-altering substances which can create the appearance that the person has plunged into a very deep and profound depression. One of the things our intelligence sources have talked to us about is the study of suicide clusters in which there is a suspicion that the Russian state may have either driven individuals to kill themselves or has so successfully destabilized them that when their deaths are made to look like suicides, there's a pretext on which that can be made believable because their behavior in the weeks leading up to their death has been so disordered.
Now, a lot of the Russian exiles who became opponents and eventually targets of the Kremlin, some former oligarchs, and in some cases not the most admirable of people, seemed to settle in Great Britain. Why was it a favored destination for these exiles?
Well, London in lots of ways kind of made the perfect playground for these super rich Russians who fled Vladimir Putin's regime, because it's a place where, you know, that there is a kind of degree of respectability about investing your money in the United Kingdom. But actually, the vagaries of the British financial system make it very easy to establish shell companies with fairly little scrutiny into which money can be moved. And it's actually has been historically and to some extent still to this day very easy to plough huge amounts of money into British properties, British companies and British banks without a huge amount of scrutiny from the authorities. And so, you know, it was possible for these Russian runaways to come to Britain, to expatriate huge fortunes and reinvest them, and then also to kind of launder their reputations into the West by sending their children to some of the most prestigious public schools that Britain has to offer, to making endowments to the colleges of leading universities in Britain, buying up some of the most prestigious stately homes in the country, and really kind of crafting a life that bore all the hallmarks of kind of British establishment respectability, but which was funded entirely by money, much of which had been, you know, expatriated from Russia in fairly corrupt and dubious circumstances.
Now, a lot of what you deal with in this book is the British government's attitude towards these suspicious deaths. How did the government generally regard these oligarchs arriving from Russia? And for that matter, you know, British business interests in Russia, how did they figure into the British government's attitude towards these events?
Well, the kind of inflow of Russian money into the British economy has been a major boon, particularly given the decline of the British manufacturing industry and the increasing reliance on financial services to prop up the British economy. So there's been a great eagerness on the part of the British authorities to welcome in these Russian runaways and to dole out investment visas, which are basically grants of, you know, the right to remain in the country to those who can afford to invest you know, the requisite sums of money in the economy. And so there's been in lots of ways, you know, a decision by government to kind of roll out the red carpet and let wealthy Russians into the country. And you know, as a result, fairly soon after Putin came to power, huge sums of money, you know, tens of billions a year were pouring into the British economy from these wealthy Russian oligarchs who'd been attracted here. And also, you know, from major Russian companies floating on the London Stock Exchange and all sorts of other routes. And, you know, at the same time, Britain is a major investor in Russian energy projects as well. So there are all sorts of reasons why the British government has been keen to preserve that flow of Russian money into Britain. But at the same time, fairly soon after this kind of cast of Russian runaways arrived, it became clear that they were accompanied by some pretty major security threats. And I think that's where the British government found itself in a bit of a double bind, wanting to welcome these enemies of the Russian state in, but then also not wanting to have a confrontation with the Kremlin when threats to their lives emerged on British soil.
So let's talk about some of these characters that began disappearing and dying in Britain. A key player among these exiles was Boris Berezovsky, who became a prominent opponent of Putin in Britain. Tell us just a little bit about his days in Russia and how he ran afoul of Vladimir Putin.
Boris Berezovsky was known in Russia as the godfather of the oligarchs because he was really chief amongst those who made a massive fortune buying up you know, what had been formerly state-owned companies in the kind of fire sale auctions in Boris Yeltsin's post-communist Russia, buying them up at rock bottom prices and becoming kind of billionaires overnight when they achieved their real value. And he also credited himself with having been Putin's kingmaker. It was really, certainly in his own telling of it, him who had plucked Putin from obscurity, from his position as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, brought him to Moscow, ingratiated him with the Kremlin and ultimately smoothed his path to power. But pretty soon after Putin arrived at the Kremlin, he fell out with Berezovsky in a very big way. Putin quickly moved towards autocracy. He made it clear to the oligarchs who'd grown so rich under Yeltsin that their power was going to be seriously curtailed in his Russia. He cracked down on media free speech. Now, Berezovsky was a big, you know, it was a big media baron by that time. He owned Channel One and major newspapers in Russia. And Putin made it clear that media freedoms were going to be heavily curtailed. And so Berezovsky began to lash out against his protege, began to attack Putin very publicly. And it was made clear to him in the form of a series of arrest warrants issued from the Kremlin that that he was no longer welcome in Russia. And that was when Berezovsky fled to the United Kingdom.
Right. Now, a lot of oligarchs who fled with their money from Russia were happy enough to enjoy lives of yachting and five-star hotels. Berezovsky was different, wasn't he?
That is right. Berezovsky just couldn't stop poking the bear once he got to the United Kingdom. He used his new perch in the rolling green hills of Surrey. Once he'd managed to expatriate the huge amounts of wealth that he had made for himself in Russia, to finance an international campaign of opposition to Putin's government. He funded investigations into Putin's links to organized crime in Russia, which are extensive, and his involvement in the series of apartment bombings and other atrocities in Moscow that had long been suspected in some circles. And he also did everything he could to stoke unrest on Russia's doorstep. He financed the 2004 and 5 Orange Revolution in Ukraine, for example, and did his best to stoke unrest in Georgia and Belarus and elsewhere in the region. And so he really did make it his business to antagonize the Kremlin in every way he possibly could. And on more than one occasion, he actually called for armed revolution in Russia and suggested that he had been plotting the overthrow, the violent overthrow of Putin's regime.
Right. I got to say, this is a fascinating description of his little nest of anti-Putin figures. I mean, there was like a Chechen leader who lived across the street. There were just various people who would come and go, and he had unlimited amounts of money to spend on this. And of course, he was spending a lot on lawyers to launder the assets that he had liquidated in Russia. He also had kind of a weird, kinky lifestyle, didn't he? I mean, not the most admirable of people.
That's certainly true. Yeah, one of the real challenges for the police officers who were tasked with protecting Berezovsky when it became clear that there were various active plots to kill him on British soil was the fact that he not only insisted on taking a penis enlargement formula that he was having shipped in from Moscow, which they were seriously concerned exposed him to risk of poisoning. But he also was bringing plane loads of teenage sex workers from the Baltic states into Britain on his private jet. He was going out to the plane and kind of holding kind of live auditions on the tarmac. And the escorts who made the cut were brought into the country and kept at various hotel suites and at a smart address in Belgravia, and others were just sent straight back home if they didn't make the cut. He certainly was leading a pretty seedy lifestyle on British soil, and all the while he was being protected by the British police, who, you know, were constantly fending off a stream of live assassination plots against him.
Now, there's another character in the drama is a young, dashing young Scotsman who has the unlikely name of Scott Young. Tell us about him and the service that he performed for Berezovsky.
Well, Scott Young was really Berezovsky's bagman. He was the guy who knew how to plow Berezovsky's money into a really dazzling array of British properties and luxury cars and shell companies and offshore trusts. And so he was there once Berezovsky arrived to help him spend his money in Britain. But he was also, in many ways, an incredibly colourful character himself. He was embroiled in a series of very risky business deals in Moscow, one of which went very bad. And he spent the last years of his life terrified that he was being teamed by a tail of Russian hitmen, you know, calling the police and asking for protection and telling them that he believed his life was in danger and he feared he was going to be poisoned. And he ultimately fell to his death from a fourth floor bedroom window and was impaled on the spikes of a wrought iron fence underneath.
Now, in 2006, this is remarkable, Putin actually gets a law passed legalizing assassinations by Russian intelligence services on foreign soil, right? I mean, how unusual is that?
That's right. It was an extraordinary moment. And those laws were passed just as Russia was preparing to host the G8 summit in St. Petersburg in 2006, with Putin as the president of the G8. And that really is almost the kind of apotheosis of attempts by the West to bring Putin in from the cold and kind of integrate him into the cozy club that is the, you know, the series of institutions and alliances that underpin the liberal world order. And so even as Western leaders were sitting around the table with Putin in St. Petersburg, at that very moment, laws were being passed through the Russian parliament that enabled enemies of the Russian state to be murdered by Russian state agents on foreign soil with absolute impunity. And all the while, Litvinenko was trying to warn publicly that this would mean that Russian defectors living in Britain would be at risk. And it was only months later that he himself was assassinated.
You know what puzzled me about it was, why would he? I mean, they don't particularly pay attention to the law anyway, right? I mean, they do these things and then deny them. Did the law have a purpose other than legalizing these operations?
I think the purpose of the law within Russia was really to strengthen the hand of the FSB and to give it, you know, elevated status and to kind of create a legislative framework for the kind of global killing campaign, you know, which really had been part of the Russian state security playbook for a long time and had been part of the FSB's modus operandi. But it was really about legitimizing that course of action in Russia. And actually also, about pretty brazenly sending a message to the West about what Putin's intentions were. Around the time that those laws were passed, the Cold War defector Oleg Gordievsky wrote a letter to the Times in which he warned that by passing those laws, what Putin was really doing was making the leaders of the West complicit in the killing campaign that he was about to escalate, because they were sitting around the table with him at the very time those laws were passed. And by not saying a word, by continuing to court him and continuing to work with him, they had almost implicitly endorsed the course of action he'd made it very clear he intended to take.
We're listening to the interview Dave Davies recorded with Heidi Blake, Global Investigations Editor for BuzzFeed News and author of the new book, From Russia with Blood, The Kremlin's Assassination Program and Vladimir Putin's Secret War on the West. After a break, they'll talk about the strange death of a Russian defector in a Washington hotel room and about how reporters on the BuzzFeed team were followed when they were investigating the Russian assassinations. Also, Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of music performed by the late jazz pianist Errol Garner. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments.
We're speaking with Heidi Blake. She's Global Investigations Editor at BuzzFeed News. Her book is From Russia with Blood, The Kremlin's Ruthless Assassination Program and Vladimir Putin's Secret War on the West. When the men associated with this exile group began dying, a couple of lawyers died. One was in a helicopter crash, another of an apparent heart attack, although his home was then broken into. And then others, I mean, eventually Berezovsky and Litvinenko. How aggressively were these deaths investigated by British authorities?
Well, the really extraordinary feature of this pattern of killing for us when we began investigating it at BuzzFeed News was that we could see there was a pattern of suspicious deaths linked to Russia that really had started very shortly after Berezovsky and his associates moved to the UK. And in every single case, there was evidence that would appear to connect those deaths to Russia, even on the face of it. And yet in every single case, there had been little or no investigation. Any serious inquiry had been shut down, and the deaths had been designated non-suspicious. And that for us was the thing that was most suspicious, actually, about the whole picture, was that there were 14 deaths here with very clear links to Russia. Some of which had occurred in circumstances which just simply seemed to beg a belief. You know, in one case, an individual directly in the crosshairs of the Kremlin who had apparently stabbed himself to death repeatedly with two knives, and there'd been no investigation. It had immediately been treated as a suicide. And the fact that there'd been no investigation really in any of these cases was the thing that made us think, well, something's very wrong with this picture.
And were you able to uncover evidence suggesting that there was interference, or what happened?
Well, in lots of these cases, we kind of went back over the evidence at the time of the death. So, you know, in the case of the death of Scott Young, for example, the financier for Berezovsky and many of his associates who fell from his window and was impaled on the railings, the police came in and within minutes had shut that case down and treated it as a suicide. We were able to establish that, in fact, the police had been called repeatedly by Scott Young in the months and years leading up to his death, that he told them that he feared he was being tailed by a team of Russian hitmen. He feared his life was in danger, that his daughters had gone to the police and told them that he had been complaining that he feared for his life and that he didn't believe he was safe. And then, of course, we unraveled this whole series of connections to a number of deals in Russia that had come directly into the crosshairs of the Kremlin, that had angered the Kremlin, and that, you know, that he had been living in the shadow of serious threats. And none of that had been investigated. The police hadn't even dusted for fingerprints in his apartment. They hadn't taken any CCTV footage. They hadn't sought extra witnesses. They'd really done absolutely nothing to investigate. They hadn't even taken photos of the window ledge from which he fell. And if they had, they would have seen that there were scratches on the ledge, which were later found by his daughters, which were about as far apart as the fingers on two hands, suggesting that he may have been fighting to stay in when he fell out. And so really just the complete absence of any serious investigation by the police suggested to us that there was a kind of strategic unwillingness on the part of the British authorities to look any further.
Did you find cases in which the Foreign Service actually instructed that documents would be sealed or investigations would be limited?
Well, yeah, there are a number of cases in which the British government has obtained secrecy orders to prevent evidence being disclosed to inquests, which are the formal investigations into cause of death, which take place, when deaths in Britain are unexplained. I think the most striking example is the death of a man called Gareth Williams, who was a British spy who was found dead in the apartment, which was paid for by the British intelligence services in London. He was found zipped up and padlocked inside a large sports bag, which had been placed inside the bathtub of his flat. And the authorities very quickly shut that investigation down and deemed it as non-suspicious. Now, I was able to talk to the murder detective who was the first on the scene of Gareth Williams's death, who said that he believed that the scene was too clean. It appeared to have been cleaned up and wiped down. There were no fingerprints anywhere in the flat. There were no fingers anywhere on the bathtub or on the bag zipper, which was pretty much impossible if Gareth Williams had zipped himself into the bag himself, which was the line that the police ultimately took. But that investigation had been taken over by the counter-terror police, who are the unit who liaise most closely with Britain's intelligence services. And that detective was very strongly of the view that that had been done in order to conceal the involvement of some foreign state in Gareth Williams's death. And what we were able to establish was that what he had been working on was strongly linked to Russia, and that there was intelligence suggesting that he had been assassinated as a result of that work.
What do you think might be the explanation for the British government's reluctance to treat these cases more seriously?
Well, that's a really burning question at the heart of our investigation. And we've spent, a huge amount of time talking to, I think it's more than 40 current and former intelligence and law enforcement sources on both sides of the Atlantic to try to unravel that. And the answer is kind of complex and multi-layered, but I think at the heart of it is a desire by the British government to foster close relations with the Kremlin. Putin was very strategically important as an ally for the West in the war on terror. He was seen as a critical ally in the Middle East and in Syria for many years. He was, seen as a crucial part of the Iran nuclear deal and the resistance to Iran's development of nuclear weapons. There were many kind of reasons at a grand geopolitical scale why the West wanted to try to bring Putin in from the cold and try to cultivate an alliance with him. And then along with that, there is the huge amount of Russian money that has really propped up the British economy through the throughout the recession and beyond. And there is the central importance of Britain's energy investments in Russia, and the fact that Europe and Britain are pretty reliant on Russian energy to just keep the lights on. And so there are lots of reasons why Britain has wanted to continue to curry favour with Putin. But on top of all of that, there's the fact that Putin's ascent to power coincided with, just came just before 9/11. And after that, really all of the focus of British and American intelligence gathering and security spending and resource was on the war on terror. And so the kind of capabilities of the elements of those agencies that are dedicated to monitoring Russian threats really, was really, really undermined by that. And so there was also a sense in which Britain was weakened in its ability to detect and to respond to these threats, as well as being, as well as just being keen to keep the Kremlin close.
Heidi Blake is Global Investigations Editor at BuzzFeed News. Her new book is From Russia with Blood. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Capital One, a new savings account earns 5 times the national average. That's 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition, or maybe even an addition on that addition. Capital One is helping you earn more towards your savings goals. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
On our brand new season of the StoryCorps podcast from NPR, you'll hear challenging conversations between friends, family members, and sometimes people who could have easily been enemies as they bridge divides and build connections where you'd least expect it. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
We're speaking with Heidi Blake. She's Global Investigations Editor for BuzzFeed News. Her new book is based on the work of a team of BuzzFeed reporters who investigated multiple assassinations and suspicious deaths of critics of Vladimir Putin in the United Kingdom and in at least one case in the United States. Her book is From Russia with Blood, The Kremlin's Ruthless Assassination Program and Vladimir Putin's Secret War on the West. There was this case of this security expert, Paul Joyal, who was shot in Maryland and survived. And then more recently, the death of a Putin defector in Washington, D.C., Mikhail Lessin, who was Putin's former kind of communications and propaganda guy. You want to tell us about that case?
Yeah, that's a pretty extraordinary case, and it really represented the realization of a long-held fear in the U.S. intelligence community that a kind of tide of suspicious death on British soil was going to carry across the Atlantic and reach American shores. British and American intelligence officials had been observing this dark trend for a long time and had been increasingly concerned about it. But this was the first instance of a highly suspicious death that took place in the U.S. Mikhail Lessin was the architect of the RT, the Russia Today propaganda network, that's been such a kind of crucial mechanism through which Russia has been able to propagate its kind of fake news and disinformation and kind of the alternative narrative to Western events that it likes to spread around the world. And he had fallen out of favor in Russia and had fled to the US, where he was preparing to talk to the Department of Justice. The morning after his death, he was due to meet with officials and to begin to dish information to them about the makings of that kind of crucial mechanism of the Russian propaganda machine. Before he was able to get to that meeting, he was found bludgeoned to death in his hotel room. He had blunt force injuries to the head, the neck, the arms, the chest, the torso. He also had a broken bone in his neck. So it was a pretty extraordinary case, and there was a short-lived investigation, after which it was announced by the FBI that Mikhail Lessin had bludgeoned himself to death by falling over repeatedly in his hotel room while drinking alone the night before this meeting. That was a conclusion that many FBI agents who'd worked on that case and intelligence officials we spoke to found extremely hard to swallow, given the severity of the injuries that Lessin sustained and his obvious, the obvious threat to him as a Kremlin insider who was preparing to flip and start talking to the U.S. government.
Right. And we should note that Lessin himself did have a very serious drinking problems. That's one of the things that led to his falling out with Putin.
That's right.
But this just on its face seems really unlikely. Was there follow-up from Congress? Is there some explanation for why this would be treated this way?
It's a pretty extraordinary conclusion, as you say. I mean, it's true that Lessin had a serious drinking problem, but nonetheless, managing to beat yourself to death by falling repeatedly in a carpeted hotel room is sort of stretches credulity. The investigation has remained closed. We have done a lot of reporting, and there's been a lot of questions raised publicly about that conclusion into Lessin's death. But as yet, there's no sign that investigation is going to be reopened or that conclusion is going to change. I think it came at a really delicate moment for U.S. relations with the Kremlin. There'd just been a spate of cyber attacks on the White House emanating from Russia. There was at the time growing consternation over Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But at the same time, Putin was playing a really key role in the formulation of the Iran nuclear deal, and also was seen as a hugely critical regional ally in Syria. or at least a potential ally in Syria. We kind of know how that ended now. But there was, I guess, the same set of reasons why the British authorities have struggled to deal decisively with these suspicious circumstances of some of the other deaths we've examined in the UK. It's always an unappetizing prospect, antagonizing the Kremlin over an isolated incident, a single death. One of the things that some of the intelligence officials who we talked to said to us was that, you know, we have to keep our eyes on the really big strategic questions here. We're trying to figure out what Russia's intentions are in Ukraine, what their nuclear ambitions are, what their intentions are in Syria. We have to keep our eyes at that kind of strategic level rather than getting bogged down in the details.
Right. And I guess we should note, since anyone might suspect that this could be attributed to President Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin, this was during the Obama administration that Lessen died. There's one other attack I think we ought to talk about. This was in March of last year on Sergei Skripal. Do I have the name right? He was a former Russian spy and his daughter. This was particularly troubling because of the nature of it. You want to tell us about this?
Yeah, the attack on Sergei and Yulia Skripal really was a kind of watershed moment in Anglo-Russian relations. This was a brazen attack in broad daylight on the streets of the city of Salisbury, in which, you know, assassins from Russia or attempted assassins from Russia had smeared the nerve agent Novichok on the door handle of Sergei Skripal's home. Now, in doing so, they not only exposed the Skripals to this deadly nerve agent, which, you know, marked the first attack on European soil using a chemical weapon since the Second World War. They'd also exposed hundreds of members of the British public to this toxic substance. There is no more conspicuously Russian poison available than Novichok, which was developed by the Soviets, from Russia's chemical weapons stockpile, which is a substance of which British and American intelligence agencies are well aware. It originates in Russia. It's a message with a very clear return address from the Kremlin, and this was just a brazen provocation that the British government could not possibly ignore. It was. Theresa May stood up and accused the Kremlin of having been involved in ordering that attempted assassination. And that triggered waves of diplomatic expulsions of Russian diplomats around the world. I think 150 Russian diplomats were sent packing from various outposts, and also waves of further sanctions against Russia. And so the West really did take a pretty firm line. Of course, by then, Russia's provocations had become so outlandish, you know, in terms of brazen meddling in the US election and democracies across Europe, and the overt financing of far-right extremist groups across Europe, and the invasion of Ukraine, and waves of cyber attacks against countries across the West, and the overt support for the Assad regime as he continues his attacks on his own people. And so by then, I think any hope of trying to cultivate a serious relationship with Russia had evaporated.
You know, many Russian journalists who've investigated the Kremlin have been murdered. And I'm wondering, what was the experience of you and your team as you spent years looking into this? Were you followed, bugged, threatened?
Yeah, I mean, we have just the greatest admiration for the women and men of the Russian media who every day expose themselves to great danger in their pursuit of the truth. It's just an act of extraordinary courage, and we really find it humbling and amazing. For our team, certainly, this was a dicey ride investigating this story, and we had a number of fairly disturbing instances along the way. One of us had a man in a dark car appear outside the house for many months during the course of the investigation. Somebody else had items moved around inside their home. We had members of the team very conspicuously followed in the course of the investigation. We kind of took that very seriously. We have an amazing security team at BuzzFeed News led by Elliot Stempf, who is a hero and a genius. And he had us all install trackers on our phones and panic alarms. And he kind of versed us all in some counter-surveillance techniques that we could use when going home, when meeting sources. And we had, you know, we had intruder alarms and sensors and cameras rigged up in our various homes. And ultimately, a couple of us were moved in the final phases of the project to kind of secure locations or kind of more discreet locations in home, just as a kind of additional measure. So we took that seriously. But, you know, it certainly was intimidating at times. And we just had to kind of keep focused on the importance of exposing the story.
Were any of you directly threatened?
Nobody was directly threatened. I think it was more the kind of smoke and mirrors technique, which is pretty standard for journalists and diplomats operating in Russia. The kind of there's a kind of element of mind games, I think, about what goes on. You know, if you come home and things have been moved around strangely inside your home, you're pretty sure that's a message, but you also wonder, are you imagining that? And when lots of those things happen and it starts to feel like a pattern, I think the way in which that makes you doubt your own perception of reality is kind of part of what it's actually all about. But there was enough of a pattern of events happening to enough different individuals that, you know, that we were pretty clear that this was just a kind of campaign of kind of harassment and designed to say to us, look, we're watching you, we know what you're doing, tread a little carefully. But there was nothing more overt than that. And we had our security experts at BuzzFeed kind of assessing each incident and, you know, just making assessment about the seriousness of that and the measures that we needed to take to just be responsible as we carried on with our reporting.
Well, Heidi Blake, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Heidi Blake is Global Investigations Editor for BuzzFeed News. She spoke with Dave Davies about her new book, From Russia with Blood, The Kremlin's Assassination Program and Vladimir Putin's Secret War on the West. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews one of a series of reissues by the late jazz pianist Errol Garner. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Real Real, the leading reseller for authenticated luxury consignment. Consign men's and women's luxury fashion, fine jewelry, watches, art, and home. The Real Real offers free white glove service, in-store drop-off, or from-home shipping. Think sustainably. Consign with The Real Real today and earn up to 85% commission. This month, receive site credit when you consign 10 or more items. Authentic, sustainable luxury. Only at TheRealReal.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Burlington Stores. Many people go without a winter coat to keep them warm. But Burlington wants to change that with Burlington's annual Coat Drive, hosted in partnership with Delivering Good. Now through January 20th, Burlington is accepting donations of gently worn coats at any of their stores nationwide. As a thank you, shoppers can receive 10% off their entire Burlington purchase. Find a store near you at burlington.com. Burlington, style is giving back.
The late jazz pianist Errol Garner is the subject of a new series of CD reissues of albums he recorded for various labels between 1959 and 1973. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of his pick from the series so far.
Garner, 1964, giving a big Hollywood buildup to I Found a Million Dollar Baby at the 5 and 10 Cent Store, a song from 1931. It's from his album A Night at the Movies, my favorite so far from the ongoing Octave Remastered series of Garner albums. They're being issued one a month through next June. As an album concept, Songs from the Movies is about as loose as it gets. This one's even looser, because some songs, like that last one, actually come from Broadway. A few selections are older than talking pictures, like 1913's You Made Me Love You, a vehicle for Al Jolson, who did it slower than Errol Garner does. Earl Garner is among the most charming and chipper jazz pianists. He's got that relentlessly bouncy beat, he gets a big brassy sound from piano, and he has a way of circling back to the tune during an improvisation. Those qualities and his old-timey repertoire here can make Garner sound like a throwback to 1920s novelty ragtimers. But he was a modernist as well. The German song Just a Gigolo was a favorite of Thelonious Monk. Errol Garner puts his own spin on it, tinkering with its timing his way. Garner Trio's buoyant beat was a three-way effort, with Eddie Calhoun's bass, Kelly Martin's drums, and Errol's left hand all in sync. But Garner's roaming right hand was the trio's free agent. His improvised line would step across that firm beat and slip into the cracks between accents. That line hovers over the rhythm the way his variations hover over a melody. This is Stella by Starlight. Discussions about how music makes you feel, because the same performance may evoke a wide range of reactions from different listeners. But it's hard to miss the joy that radiates from Errol Garner's piano as he spins out new and old melodies and cracks his little musical jokes. He's as listener-friendly as jazz gets. He improvises with wit, style, and grace, and he swings like mad. That joy he radiated is still contagious. You could catch it even now.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and The Audio Beat. He reviewed Night at the Movies, one in a series of reissues of recordings by pianist Errol Garner. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, I'll talk with Marielle Heller about directing A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the new film starring Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers, based on the friendship that developed between Rogers and a cynical journalist assigned to profile him. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. I'm Terry Gross.